been found and is now in the possession of the Army.
Tell me what this lady is supposed to act up to be.
Okay, we'll assume it's friendly anyway, okay?
There's two of them, and they're acting
fine
the whole time, but
I'm
sorry, like, say that.
Oh, my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh, Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please. Come on, Lisa, I ain't ready for this.
The cameraman said, what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular hit.
UFO over New York, and I ain't too surprised.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that these days like
this. Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Well, the days don't get any more normal, and this edition only adds more fuel to the ufological fire, with Dave Furlott, Stuart Miller, who at the time that his contribution was recorded for this program hadn't yet declared that Alien World magazine would cease publication, which really is too bad. And rounding us out, Canadian UFO survey compiler and author of several books, Chris Rutkowski joins us to discuss his new book, A World of UFOs.
These are Strange Days Indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Furlott.
What qualifies as proof of existence? This single question has plagued theologians, philosophers, and ufologists for millennia now. And theoretically, the answer should be easier to come by since we as a race have grown so much with our technology. Strictly from the ufological point of view, it should now be easier for people to prove when they spot a UFO or have any kind of close encounter with an extraterrestrial because of the quantity and quality of recording devices available to us. In addition to that, thanks to television shows like CSI and NCIS, we have seen that our capability to test and examine even the minutest of evidence can determine fact from fiction. Speaking from a security point of view, there are so many security cameras, surveillance satellites, and other monitoring devices that George Orwell's vision of Big Brother watching us in the novel 1984 is an accepted reality. And there is little doubt that any UFO wandering into any of our populated areas would easily be observed, scanned, tagged, and categorized every single second it remained in the area. Finally, with computers and the internet being so widespread, it allows our world to have a communication ability that means we could easily get to see and hear important events as they happen, instead of hours, weeks, or months after the fact. So, with all this capability, proving the existence of UFOs and even determining what they are and where they come from should be so easy that even my cat could do it, right? Unfortunately, wrong. We are living in a society where the recording, processing, and tabulation of information has grown so widespread that we simply do not have the capability to sift through even 0.00001% in an entire lifetime. With everyone having still and motion image capture capability built into their phones, it is fair to say that more pictures are taken in a single hour today than were taken in a year by the entire world population as little as 10 years ago. With personal computers, MP3 players, and other recording devices, people are putting together music libraries that they are incapable of being able to enjoy, because they would die before their playlist would finish. We have advanced to a point in our history where information has grown exponentially because everyone and their cat can actually contribute to the pool of information available so that it is almost impossible to tell what is bona fide information and what is garbage. But what about when we get UFO reports in today's society? Based on all the capability that we have, we should be able to easily prove that UFOs exist because we should have thousands of images, audio recordings, and should be able to see and hear all about the event even as it occurs. Surely we must be able to focus on one report long enough that we can prove the existence of UFOs to the public in general. The sad fact is that we have, and we do. But, and yeah, you knew there was a but, the release of the information is controlled by the individuals or organizations that have obtained it. For example, the incident at Chicago's O'Hare Airport on November 7th, 2006, garnered a lot of enthusiastic support because there were lots of witnesses. It happened in an area where there are tons of devices that record aerial activity, and presumably there were multiple people present with a variety of cameras to record the event. Mainstream media got involved in the story, including an investigative reporter, and that should have been it. UFOs exist, and there is the proof. But it didn't happen for several reasons. First, the FAA declared that it was nothing more than a weather phenomenon. The United Airlines flight and ground crews were told by UA head office to not discuss the matter. Hoaxed images, sound bites, and stories began to appear and mix fact with fiction, expanding the data enough so that any ufologist wanting to investigate the report in depth would have to spend years, if not decades, sifting through everything just to determine reality from fiction. And finally, the entire event got forgotten as other news and events happened in the world around us. For decades now, ufologists throughout the world have been focusing on trying to prove that UFOs exist and have been working with the millennia-old question, what qualifies as proof of existence? We have visual and audible evidence. We have trace evidence obtained from locations where UFOs have landed, crashed, or come into contact with areas of our planet. But we also have visual and audible evidence and trace evidence that has been manufactured by individuals or organizations, mixed in with the real information, so we are no longer sure what is real and what is not. The question is no longer what qualifies as proof of existence, because we now have too much information available that meets all the qualifications. The question we should now be asking is, how can we prove existence when there is too much evidence? But that's just my take on it.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange Days, indeed.
Well, I look at my hard drives, and I have 30 gigs worth of music that I transferred.
Mm-hmm.
LPs and cassettes and CDs.
And I challenge you to be able to listen to it all.
Well, over the years, I've heard it as it goes in, you know?
Yeah.
But going back and listening to it all again? maybe not.
See, that's what I'm talking about.
There just isn't the time, is there?
No, there just is not, to be quite blunt. And it literally is that. I mean, there are collections of data that people are compiling, whether it be music, whether it be video, whether it be reading material, and they are collecting it for the sake of collecting it, which is perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But quite literally, they really, in truth, could not enjoy all of it. They have to be very selective and pick and choose. And again, there's nothing wrong with that. But that's what I'm saying. There is really so much data out there right now. And I touched on it saying that, yeah, even the cat can do it. You go into places like MySpace, Facebook, whatever, and you see people that have their animals with accounts in there. Obviously, they're doing stuff to say, okay, this is Felix the cat, and today I woke up and I found me a sunbeam and stuff like that. But by the same token, theoretically, that's part and parcel of our data stream.
Really, it's like expecting new subscribers to UFO updates to go to the archive where there are 75,000 posts, and expecting them to go through it all before they start asking questions on them.
Yeah. Some of them may very well be trying to go through it all, and I wish them luck.
It really is starting to become daunting and also crazy-making.
Mm-hmm. And part and parcel of it as well is it's not only the bona fide report that's out there, but it's also the stuff like the infamous Reed and Wraith stuff that comes out, basically becomes manufactured evidence for whatever reason. Somebody trying to make money, somebody trying to confuse us, and that's exactly what it ends up doing, is it does mix in and it does cause confusion, particularly when you get somebody that's brand new that gets all excited and interested in ufology. We see it all the time. We see people coming in and saying, hey, wow, I just discovered the alien autopsy film.
We've had a few of those over the years.
Exactly.
Too.
It's like, oh, God, okay. And then we have to explain to the person that what you were looking at has been manufactured.
It's rather like Behold the Pale Horse. It's amazing how many people got their starts in looking into UFOs through that book.
To be blunt, I got my start with von Daniken's Chariot of the Gods.
Yeah, well, he had some interesting things to say there.
He did, too. I still look back fondly on that book, and there were some things that had me scratching my head, to say the least.
Yeah. Some interestings going on the list of late. Those so-called scientists down in Florida decrying the fact that a museum down there would invite Stan Friedman to speak there because he's a charlatan and a pseudoscientist.
Yeah, that one really rankles me, actually. Regardless of what Stanton does within ufology, which is magnificent work to begin with, he is a bona fide scientist. He's a physicist. The bottom line is, this man is a scientist.
When that first came up, courtesy of Billy Cox's blog down there at the Sarasota Herald Tribune in Florida, I thought, as I posted the story to the list, I thought, I wonder how long it's going to be before we hear from Stan Friedman that he's going to sue their buns.
Oh, yeah.
And it wasn't very long after that he said, as soon as he got a couple of things out of the way, he was going to talk to his lawyer about these guys.
I don't blame him in the least. I hope that his lawyer says that he has a case and that he should go forward with it and should win.
I would definitely think that he had a case.
That's just wrong on so many levels.
Dave Furlott, thank you.
Thank you, my friend.
An interesting take yet again.
Good.
DavidFurlott.com is David's website. We'll talk to you soon.
For sure.
Thank you.
Have a good one.
You too.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
Every other program we head across the pond, our British correspondent and publisher of Alien Worlds magazine joins us. This time is no exception, on the line with us from his home in Cheshire in the United Kingdom. Stuart Miller joins us. Good day, sir.
And good day to you and everybody else.
How are ufological things in the United Kingdom?
Well, they've taken an interesting turn just a few days ago with this deeply intriguing helicopter incident over Birmingham.
Mm-hmm.
a police helicopter incident. At this stage, and I'm sure this one will run and run, at this stage it does seem to be very odd. A police helicopter had to swerve out of the way of a mystery aircraft while it was on routine police surveillance. Two police officers at around 10 to 10 of an evening on May the 2nd reported seeing an aircraft. Interesting, it's been described as an aircraft with two continuous blue-green lights, but were unable to identify what it was. And the thing is that this thing approached to within less than 100 meters away and flew around the helicopter as if it was up to mischief. One line of thought was, well, this is somebody on the ground playing silly bees with a radio-controlled aircraft. That was ruled out. They didn't recognize it as a radio-controlled aircraft. And also, they had infrared camera equipment on board and searched the area and could not detect any radio-controlled aircraft activity on the ground. In other words, they couldn't identify anybody who appeared to be in control of such an object. And Nick Pope has got himself worked up about this, and I think with some justification. It's interesting, really, with Nick, because of his background, because he has always pursued the air safety side of UFOs as well. And this is something that he's shouting loudly about in this case. With some justification, that obviously beggars the question, what the hell was it? If it wasn't some sophisticated kind of toy, what was it? Because it certainly wasn't a Chinese wedding lantern. That can be stated quite categorically. The other thing as well that legislates against a radio-controlled aircraft was that the altitude was too high as well.
I posted the initial report to the list and follow-ups. Do we know how many people were aboard the helicopter?
Three in total. The pilot and two observers.
And of course all their reports matched.
Yes. The front observer made visual contact first. The pilot also established visual contact as he was maneuvering the helicopter out of the way. Yes, there's been no conflict in the witness testimony.
I wonder if there's been any video footage of that encounter.
That's a very good question. Nothing has been said about that. I wouldn't be surprised, though.
It seems to me that there would be, because every police car, every police vehicle has a video camera that's constantly recording. So there must be at least a few frames of that object whipping around the helicopter.
Well, you would think.
Mm-hmm.
Now, bear in mind, this happened at the beginning of May, has only just come to light. I would think on the balance of probabilities there is video evidence, but that's not been released yet. We get to hear about this incident, what, some 7 months after it happened. I wouldn't be surprised if video evidence after some consideration did emerge as well.
Was that a leak or was that an official statement?
It doesn't seem to have been a leak, no. Picked up in a report to Airprox. There is a report compiled by experts from the Airprox board.
That's presumably the air proximity people?
Sorry, you're right. It records near misses and reports them to the military and air traffic control unit. So that's how it's been published.
And I guess some eagle-eyed UFO sleuth came across that.
It's been picked up by the papers, by the media. I don't know this, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if it was actually put out as a press release. There seems to be a complete change of attitude to reporting incidents like that these days. A very different attitude indirectly. We can probably thank Dr. David Clark for that. There has been an about-face. What's also interesting, I think, as well, is the way that this matter's been reported, even the, in some ways, the article headline, UFO involved in a dramatic incident. And in this instance, the term or the word UFO is used in its strict sense. In other words, there isn't a hint of any sort of implication of extraterrestrial intent or activity. It is an unidentified flying object.
And that seems to be the route that several researchers are going now. I'm thinking of NARCAP in the United States. Don Ledger is the Canadian representative for NARCAP, the National Aviation Reporting Center on Anomalous Phenomena, and they are going after the air traffic safety aspects of these kinds of encounters, which seems to work much better than, oh, a UFO.
Yes, Yes, yes. It's a nuanced change of approach, which I guess probably attracts a degree more press seriousness and respectability in the attention it's given. And I suppose, really, it is the correct approach to take. We don't know what this is. I have to say I'm generally quite cynical, really, about citing reports, but this one is deeply intriguing. There are, of course, all manner of explanations. It could have been something military, but why would it then sort of play cat and mouse, so to speak, with a helicopter? I don't think the military are that stupid or arrogant, but you never know. Either way, it does appear to be something solid, made from nuts and bolts, and I hope more information comes out about it, because I'd like to know what it was about.
Interesting, in the article that I posted to UFO Updates from the Birmingham Mail, and that was on the 21st of November. As you said, it was initially believed that the object was a radio-controlled aircraft, and it was purposefully flown around the helicopter. Despite searching the area with a thermal camera, the helicopter pilot was unable to find any signs of radio-controlled model activity.
Yeah.
I would think that the instant reaction upon spotting this thing would be to fire up the cameras if they weren't, in fact, already fired up. So be interesting to see if people like David Clark can winkle out a video of the event.
Well, I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised if there were inquiries being made discreetly in the background. The only cautionary note, perhaps the emphasis on the word discreet, because we had another incident, if you remember, involving a police helicopter some months back over Cardiff. The people on board reported seeing a UFO, which did indeed turn out to be a Chinese wedding lantern, and a number of people committed to it to start with. When I say committed to it, a number of researchers got quite excited initially simply because it was a police helicopter. And of course, policemen are trained observers, and which is, I believe, a fallacy, but nevertheless, it is widely believed that people like the police and the military are trained observers, and they aren't going to make a historical mistake like that. It does seem that in that instance they did. So I would imagine there is much more caution and discretion involved in this incident. But I wouldn't be surprised if there were questions being asked behind the scenes. I don't think this is the last of this incident. It is too intriguing. It is too interesting.
As I often say, it'll be interesting to see what the results of further inquiries are.
Indeed. I get the feeling that a lot of people have by now got thoroughly sick of the sight and sound of Gary McKinnon, the British hacker who has lost his fight to avoid being extradited to the United States to stand trial for being a criminal mastermind who got very close to bringing the entire Pentagon machine down to his knee, you know.
Yeah, bringing everything down.
Exactly.
What nonsense.
This man is fighting tooth and nail to the last, you know, to the last moment, possibly. Only he's still here, despite having had his final appeal rejected by the House of Lords. Not only that, I think he put an appeal to Europe. I'm not sure whether it was the International Court of Human Rights or whatever, but he did appeal to Europe, and that was rejected as well. I think he's appealed to the Home Secretary, and she has rejected his appeal. And finally, he's trying to get to the Prime Minister, who has actually issued one of those vague political statements. I think there was a question put to the Prime Minister in the House of Commons, and Gordon Brown replied simply that the UK and the US are signatories to the Council of Europe Convention on the Transfer of Sentenced Persons, which enables a person found guilty in the United States of America to serve their sentence, in the UK. Interesting. So there is an interesting twist in that statement, taking the obvious that we all know that everybody signed up to this, but maybe that is the let out for Gary McKinnon. Possibly the American authorities might agree to him serving his sentence.
But he's been branded as a terrorist. And when you look at Guantanamo, Gitmo, and look at the number of people being held there without trial, if the Bush regime's rules apply on into after January, when Obama becomes president, then the likelihood of McKinnon, if he's actually extradited to the States, tried and found guilty, the chances of him being sent back to the UK are slim to slim and none.
You've put your finger on it, but I think you're drawing the wrong conclusion. I think if he can hang on until the new administration takes power, then it's quite possible that he might be able to avoid actually being extradited. I feel that.
Well, I trust that your feeling is correct. And of course, then he's also appealing to the European Court of Appeals.
Yeah, he's lost that. That's been rejected.
Oh, it has?
Yeah. Other than it's an emotional sort of appeal because he's got Asperger's syndrome.
Yeah.
Which I think really, to be honest, is a red herring. I mean, it's true that he's got it, but I think the suggestion is that a period of incarceration in a foreign jail would...
not help his health.
No, indeed. But he's down to this now. He's down basically to the emotive level. He's run out of all legal options. But he's still here, you know. and stories about him keep popping up from time to time. I wish him the best. But I hope he still does manage to avoid it. It'll be quite an escape if he does wriggle out of it. I think there has been a decreasing amount of sympathy for him. I think Billy Cox in a recent post was quite negative about it.
What are the odds of the British saying, well, we'll hang on to him, you try him in absentia, if you find him guilty, we'll put him in jail here?
None whatsoever. We have a robot for a Home Secretary at the moment. It's a woman, although the gender, of course, is irrelevant. She's continuing the path that David Lunkett, a previous Home Secretary, started, of leading us into, I wouldn't say authoritarian, but certainly extremely big brotherish climate in the UK. I mean, we're there already, and this is not a woman who is in any way interested in bucking the trend or standing up for individual human rights. She's basically a mouthpiece, and if this was a conservative Home Secretary, then we would at least have some understanding. But this is a Labour Home Secretary, and it's utter garbage. It really is. The same thing, of course, happened in America and perhaps other countries as well, but we're well ahead of America in terms of big brotherism over here. It's got really intrusive, and it's spread. It's spread to local councils. It's all based on the fight against terrorism. That's the excuse that every intrusion into our private lives is hung on. And it's just got ridiculous. It's just got absolutely ridiculous. And people don't say anything. So Jackie Smith, the Home Secretary, is not somebody that is going to turn around and say, no, I think that Gary McKinnon should be given some sort of extra chance. She'll pack him off.
And I imagine that the Pentagon and NASA and all of the other computers that Gary McKinnon cracked because their security sucked will have beefed up the security on their systems now.
I was going to say, you do know, or maybe you don't, but there is going to be a film of some sort. I'm not sure if it's a feature film or a documentary. I think it's a feature film based on his life.
That should be exciting.
Yes. It stands a chance. It stands a chance of some sort of getting made, because the person that is writing it has another film in production at this moment. And the man who wrote The Men Who Stare at Goats. I was going to mention, actually, that The Men Who Stare at Goats is currently in production with George Clooney. That's something I'm looking forward to. For those that aren't familiar with the book, it was a look at a series of programs that the American intelligence community ran in the early 60s that were sort of way out there, heavily involved in paranormal thinking. Well, Colonel John Alexander, who has been involved in the UFO world and is part of the famed aviary and cohort of my good friend Rick Doty, he was heavily involved in those programs. There were people that thought that with enough concentration, a soldier could walk through a wall. There was a thinking that if you stared at a goat for long enough, you could will it to die. And George Clooney is making the film with a very good cast, actually, with Ewan McGregor, Kevin Spacey. Mm. And it's currently being shot in New Mexico at this moment. I'm sure UFOs will somehow or other get a dollop of coverage in that. But the gentleman who wrote that book is the gentleman that's writing or written the screenplay about Gary McKinnon.
It'll probably come out after the residue has settled from the potential for Gary McKinnon being extradited.
Oh, indeed, yes. I mean, this is something a year or two in the future. I've been deeply intrigued by this article, which has had some coverage on updates by Gustavo Fernandez, which was kindly translated for us by Scott Corrales, called When Ufologists Become Skeptics. And although he does take a slightly different tack to the tack that many people that offer by way of explanation as to why ardent believers end up becoming doubters, I still think it's a load of arrogant nonsense. It's been interesting, the coverage that has attracted our updates. I do agree with most of what's been written. I'm surprised that nobody's been a bit cross about it, because I do think it is arrogant. He's saying, effectively, that people become frustrated with the UFO question, and that frustration turns to anger. They give up ever expecting to resolve the situation, and instead, as a consequence, move to the dark side, so to speak.
You haven't moved to the dark side, despite your seeming increased skepticism.
One of the weaknesses in the argument, in his argument, is that he completely blurs the line between debunkers and skeptics, as many people of his ilk do, and tends to lump them together, and actually applauds an Argentinian UFO-based organization, Red Argentina de OVNI Logia, who have barred skeptics from their membership, and he applauds that action. But skeptics and debunkers are three words or two words that go together. And, of course, there is a world of difference. That squat little fellow, the astronomer, who really is an unpleasant character, he's a debunker.
Oh, James McGahey.
Yes, McGahey, yes. Yeah, now that's Maguhu. Yeah. And there are others like him. I don't think Phil Klass was a debunker. He could be debunkerish, but I think he debunked the hysteria. I'm fairly sure there are a number of cases where he threw his hands up, and I think he accepted that he couldn't come up with an explanation in quite a few cases, and I think Klass was a heavy-duty skeptic.
I think that there are a number of people out there like Stan Friedman, like Professor Robert Jacobs, who was out there at the Atlas rocket testing range making film, and a number of others would strongly disagree with you about Klass just being a skeptic. He went after people like a rabid dog.
Yes, he did, but that's in many ways the point I was kind of making. Yes, he did do that, but it was the ballyhoo as much as anything. The fact that a large group of people would rise up in support and excitement of a UFO case, believing it was possibly the answer or one of the pieces in the jigsaw, when he didn't see it like that. It was almost as if, as he saw it, was to put the pin into the balloon. And yes, he would go after people viciously. By all accounts, he wasn't really a very nice man.
No, he got people like Bob Jacobs fired from their university jobs.
Yeah, that is not the action of a nice man. I mean, you can disagree philosophically with somebody, but to sue them that's malicious. I think the way that Klass was viewed came to light when he died, by way of the things that people said about him. And you didn't have to read between the lines too much.
No. Jerry Clark and others made their opinions of Klass very, very obvious on the updates list.
Coming back to this piece, it's worthy of comment, but I think it's flawed. And I think that a number of people, members of the updates list, actually made the point quite validly, in that they had reached their position through research, through reading, through experience. And I think Sean Jones, I thought, made a very good point, which is, you know, he'd done a lot of research. Now, he called himself a skeptic, but I don't think he was saying that he wasn't open. He just used discretion. And he'd got there from perhaps originally thinking that anything that was unidentified that was in the air was possibly extraterrestrial. And I think that's a reasonable journey that I think intelligent people make. And they process and get to a point where it's fairly obvious, Errol, that the vast majority of UFO literature is bunkum. Not all of it, of course, but a great deal of it is.
Mm. and a lot of extrapolation and conjecture.
Yeah, and it's a case of processing that and dumping it.
Which is much the way that I started out doing what I do, by reading everything there was and through the process of elimination, figuring out what I could or who I could rely on for information.
Yes, that's a very tricky one.
Yeah.
That's a very tricky one. The reason I say that is because even people that one relies on, occasionally you feel they've let you down.
That's one of the things that I love about the people who are on UFO updates, yourself included, is that there's a much more thoughtful approach to the subject. And granted, not everybody on the list is like that, but the great majority of people are very thoughtful and tend to examine rigorously what it is that they're coming across.
Yes, indeed, which is the way it should be. There was one story published in the middle of November which seemed to attract very little attention. It's true, it was published in a tabloid newspaper in the UK. It didn't seem to get picked up widely and has been given, as far as I can see, no coverage. Nobody's displayed any interest in it at all. But there's been no denial of what was in this story. It was a story about how the UK government had called in a special squad of specially trained FBI agents, for want of a better description. Now, it might not be true, but I've not read anything to the contrary to deny this. And it says the leading boffins, which is, I think, a word that we all hate, in Whitehall, have called in an undercover unit who will begin work in a high-tech London lab analysing unexplained photography and debris that has come about as a result of the increased number of sightings and interest in an activity involving UFOs in the UK over the last 6 months.
My reaction when seeing that was, oh, that's just like the Weekly World News and George Bush is an alien or Elvis Presley is alive and flying around in a UFO.
Well, I'm sorry, so far I've not heard you say anything I don't agree with.
Well, don't apologize. I'm glad you do. And I didn't even bother posting it. To me, it was another preposterous story out of the Sun newspaper in London, who have climbed aboard the UFO thing so hard. And, oh, look, it's affecting our circulation. It's going up. What a surprise.
Well, I've got to admit, it could easily be a pile of bunkum. The fact is, though, I've not read anything to the contrary about it. Nobody's denied it. Nobody has said it's rubbish. It's not outrageous. It's not. That's the point. It's not outrageous. You've got to get past the way that the story's been written and just ask yourself, is it viable that the UK government would contact the FBI and ask them to send over one or two or three, whatever it is, analysts, come and look at a number of UFO reports we've accumulated over the last few months. That's the essence of it. Is it unreasonable?
Is it that article that prompted the Daily Telegraph to start online anyway, publish all the, in quotation marks, genuine UFO pictures that are available to them? In fact, I think they put up something like, what, 30? 60?
Yeah, well, I don't know that this article in The Sun specifically triggered that, but The Telegraph followed the UFO pictures up with a series of other pictures in other areas like conspiracies and so on. I'm not sure if there is a connection. There's no doubt that The Sun campaign over the summer of this year relating to UFOs certainly triggered other press interest in other areas. The Sun really hammered it, but it was totally insubstantial, ridiculous pictures that people had taken with their phone cameras, an amazing UFO out at sea, which was a seagull, all sorts of rubbish like that. So, yes, in that context, and in the light of that, you certainly do have to look at this report with a very clear mind, so to speak, and you've got to be prepared to bin it. But I've not read anybody saying, well, this is rubbish. And the essence of it is this. Is it improbable that the UK government would turn to the FBI for expertise in this area? It's not improbable. Is it likely? Well, I don't know. But it's interesting.
I don't recall whether there has been, over the years, any FBI interest in UFO reports.
No, you see, this is it. It's what the article doesn't tell you as much as what it does tell you. What scientific analysis are there? Well, clearly, I would think photography analysis and examination of some debris. Well, I would have thought we would have been capable of doing that ourselves, but who knows what expertise the FBI might bring.
I'm not suggesting that it's a bad idea. It's a groaner as far as I'm concerned.
To be honest, you're probably right, but I'm intrigued by the fact that nobody's rubbished the story, and there's been no denials anywhere, that, as far as I'm aware. If there have been anything like that, I've missed it.
And it would only lend credence to the report. And the lack of any sort of comment at all is that a lot of people have, like me, looked at it and said, oh, please.
Well,
I hope I'm wrong, but I don't think so.
The discovery of exoplanets continues at pace. Another three were discovered quite recently, and I think the number now is well over 300. But, in fact, I think you have just put this story up on the updates list. I've just seen it in my inbox.
From the New Scientist, yes.
Indeed. Why the universe may be teeming with aliens. And the essence of this article is that, so far, scientists have judged exoplanets from the point of view of whether they've been suitable for life, not necessarily similar to us, but just capable of bearing life, based on what they call the Goldilocks factor. In other words, that the planet is appropriately positioned in relation to its star, that other factors like atmosphere and so on obviously are present. The New Scientist article basically queries those assumptions and says that scientists are now beginning to broaden their thinking as to what constitutes an appropriate planet for life, and it might well be that a number of exoplanets that have been dismissed as, other than being extremely interesting, but being dismissed as being incapable of supporting life, they might be sort of looking at those again. So that is interesting. It's the old problem with this subject, really. We can only think about it from our perspective as human beings, and it's very difficult to release ourselves from those shackles. And really, it's a subject that actually requires a very expansive imagination, and it's difficult to do that.
Only time will tell.
Profound as usual, Errol.
Well, that's me. What else can I say? Of course I hope that they do discover life on other planets. Of course I hope that that life is friendly. And I hope that we're not enslaved. If we haven't been already.
Well, yes.
Or about to be by the New World Order, but that's a whole other... Let's not even go there, Errol.
There's a story that has been published and has attracted, I can safely say, with absolute certainty on this, absolutely no interest from the UFO crowd whatsoever. I'm surprised it hasn't been picked up in one or two quarters. And it is desperately relevant to UFOs, and it involves the University of British Columbia to boot as well. Researchers develop breakthrough technique to unlock the secret of plasmas.
Oh, I hadn't seen that.
Well, that's why I'm bringing it to your attention.
Well, thank you.
Yes, but you see, a plasma cloud is not as exciting as... Even though these plasma clouds, according to the Condon report, can constitute themselves into the shape of UFOs and can appear to move about sometimes intelligently and can appear to have life, they're not really as exciting as maybe a real UFO.
Yeah, except that, in quotation marks, a real UFO has been known to generate a plasma field around it.
Indeed. In fact, the article really, if anything, highlights just how little we know about the subject, if anything. But they have been tinkering with their Bunsen burners at the University of British Columbia. The sensational aspect of this is that they've developed a technique which has produced plasmas to three orders of the magnitude denser than those made with trapped atoms. It's very complicated, frankly. And I'm not really sure how the research advances our understanding. Effectively, it seems that they're playing with them in laboratories. It's interesting, actually, this article, though, because it did bring to mind a very interesting piece that Nick Redfern wrote. I think it was in the last issue of 40 and Times. Nick does really give every avenue of thought to serious alternative explanations for UFO events, and he wrote a piece about Rendlesham and queried whether it was, in fact, an experiment with ball lightning that had not necessarily gone wrong, but just was that, really.
Surely if there had been experimentation with ball lightning going on around the Rendlesham Forest at the time of the Rendlesham incident, when the United States Army Air Force and Charles Holt and the gang, also a UFO, surely somebody would have come out and said, oh, no, 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 that's us over here. Sorry, we're just experimenting with ball lightning.
No, it's... I think the Russians have been at this as well, actually. No, I think the potential is a military weapon. In fact, that's the essence. That is the essence, and coupled with plasmas. That was the essence of the Condyne report. The fact that always, always, the desire when looking at something like ball lightning, when looking at plasmas, is how can we use this for military purposes? I'm afraid that's always the case. That's what's at the root cause of the military's interest in areas like this.
And that's why we have crash retrievals.
Well, yes. But it was a very interesting article by Nick. I did read it. I can't remember all the details. And I'm not saying it is the answer to Rendlesham.
Is that article available online?
It's not.
Ah, damn.
It wasn't when I last looked. No.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What an amazingly prolific man Nick Redfern is. Every time I turn around, there's another article by him somewhere or another book.
Yes, he works very hard.
He does.
He's not afraid to take major risks, not just with body snatches in the desert, which really made him extremely unpopular amongst many people, but also with his book about the fact that the intelligence service don't really have an interest in UFOs. They do have an interest in ufologists, and the reason they have an interest in ufologists is not to do with UFOs, but to do with military defense. That didn't make him too popular either. So he's not afraid to tell it as it is. And I think a lot of people now have got Nick sort of in a grey basket somewhere, and they're thinking, they're not really quite sure what to make of it.
And looking at the wall to see what actually falls off and what sticks.
Yes, yes. He'll go down any intelligent avenue. He doesn't produce rubbish, if you know what I mean. The theory I've just mentioned about Rendlesham might be codswallop, but all he's got, by his own admission, is circumstantial evidence. As far as I can recall the article, I think he made a leap in coming to the assumption that he did, but that there was no doubt that there has been serious American military intelligence interest and R&D into the possibility of controlling ball lightning. And if you can do that, if you can send a fireball over the, you know, over the ditch into your enemy's car, just imagine
the havoc. Yes. Well, Stuart, we certainly have covered a fair bit of ground. It's good for my edification and certainly for that of the listener. And look forward to talking to you again. Thank you, sir.
A pleasure. All the best.
All the best, Stuart.
I don't have an eye, but I can get it. I don't have an eye, but I can get it. I don't have an eye, but I can get it. I'm going to do the best I can.
Kowski has been a regular contributor to this program three times a year ever since its inception. And for those of you who don't know, Chris and his partner Jeff Dittman published the Canadian Annual UFO Survey. That's what we often talk about on this program, but on occasion we talk about a new book of his, and this time we're going to talk about a new book by Chris Rutkowski. I look forward to reading it. A World of UFOs is its title. And to talk about the book and what it contains, joining us on the line from Winnipeg, Manitoba, here in Canada, is Chris Rutkowski. Good day, sir.
Hello there, Errol. Yes, we do tend to talk from time to time. It's been 10 years, has it?
Yeah, it has.
10 years.
Ten years. And in fact, the last time I heard you was on Go on CBC
yes.
Radio. And I have a recording of that, which I haven't gotten to yet.
Yes, they were chasing down spooks in Winnipeg on Halloween on that mother network. And for some reason, they decided that they weren't actually going to find spooks and ghosts and goblins. They were going to find Canadian celebrities. And apparently I was one of the celebrities. So.
Well, congratulations. Chris Rutkowski, a celebrity on the Mother Network.
Yes. Well, Can you believe it? Can you believe it?
Well, I was bowled over. So, Chris Rutkowski, a brand new book published by, again, Dundurn Press.
Yes, and this one goes a little farther afield than previous works. I've written books more regional, one on strange things in Manitoba, previous one with Jeff Dittman about unusual UFO reports across Canada, and now this one goes literally to the four corners of the globe.
Yeah, I was reading the blurb at Dundurn Press's website. Part of it says UFOs are a truly global phenomenon, and although many of the best-known cases have taken place in North America, amazing stories of witnesses' encounters with strange disc-shaped objects and their occupants have come from every corner of the globe.
Maybe I'm working from an old model globe that has the four corners, but you get the idea that UFO reports do come from all the continents.
And it's a blurb, after all, so yeah. Blurb writers tend to...
Generalize.
Is it full of cases that we've heard about, or have you managed to winkle out one or two that we haven't?
Well, I've divvied the book up into a number of sections. I have a section on the most famous cases, the ones that people will recognize, the most bizarre UFO cases, some that I consider the most interesting. And then I do go continent hopping and find, for the most part, cases that people probably wouldn't have heard of. We don't have a lot of information about cases in Asia, for example, on the North American continent. So I go into some detail there, and I go into some detail on some of the better-known European cases, the Belgian triangles and so forth. So the book will contain some cases familiar to most people, but some that probably have never heard of before. And even the ones that they've heard of, for example, my analysis of the Roswell crash and Barney and Betty Hill, I go back to the original sources, plus include some of the updated information. So I really tried to digest what we do know as of now, or don't know as of now, about what has been reported in the classics.
Old and new and updated.
And then I also have a section in the book which I simply call UFOs from A to Z, or Z, I suppose, to be proper Canadian.
We Canadians say ZZ top.
Exactly. Simply because I wanted to give people a perspective on what I've learned or understood on a variety of topics through my 30-plus years of research into the subject of UFOs. So, for example, under B, I talk about belief. What exactly constitutes belief, or disbelief for that matter? I talk about the origin of the term flying saucer, and some people know how that came about through Kenneth Arnold, but there might be some additional information you might not know. And talk about some famous ufology personalities, J. Allen Hynek and Philip Klass, for example, and just sort of a little bit about what they did or how their role really influenced what's going on in ufology even today. So it really does cover quite a lot of topics and cases throughout the entire book.
Speaking of Philip Klass, just a little while ago on this program, Stuart Miller was on, and we were talking about Philip Klass. What is your feeling about Philip Klass?
I did have some conversations with Klass while he was alive, not so many after. I do believe that he really did, in some ways, perform a valuable role in ufology by really forcing ufologists to really pull up their shorts and try and really justify some of their claims and dig into the evidence a little bit more. On the other hand, his radical and vehement debunking and skeptical nature, I think, really went over the top in some cases. As a matter of fact, I just read Firestorm.
Andruffel's book.
Yes, Andruffel's book about the life of James McDonald, and it paints a very, very sad picture of Philip Klass as someone who really was hell-bent on destroying people's reputation just because of a philosophical viewpoint. And I can see that as well. But my own discussions with Klass were generally civil, because he actually had contacted me about a few cases, the Edmund Fuhrer Langenberg case from Saskatchewan from the 1970s, and a few other points. So I think he did do some good in ufology, even though he's really painted rather negatively by most ufologists.
I think the word is vilified.
Vilified. vilified would be a very good term.
And they weren't shy of expressing their vilification shortly after he passed, as I recall on your
No, not at all.
Yeah. You cover Philip Klass. Alan Hynek, of course, you had a fair amount of truck with.
Hynek actually slept over at my place when he was in Winnipeg and got to be fairly good acquaintances. He and his family and I enjoyed the 1979 eclipse when it passed through Canada. We were all up at the Hecla Island, which is a resort a little bit north of Winnipeg. We were there with scientists from JPL, and in between all the excitement and following the eclipse, we had quite a lot of time to talk about ufology and how it's been evolving and how he sees things evolving. And it was through his encouragement that we set up what was initially called the Manitoba Center for UFO Studies, the Canadian version of QFOS. We called it McQFOS, which might have been the Scottish version, I suppose, but nevertheless, it was Canadian. And then that evolved into Ufology Research of Manitoba, and now we simply call it Ufology Research, from whence we produce our Canadian UFO surveys every year.
And of course, you and J. Allen Hynek had more in common than UFOs.
Absolutely. In fact, our paths crossed even without knowing it, because I had to do an astronomy paper in university on transient lunar phenomena. One of my first published papers in scientific journal, in the Journal of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada, on transient lunar phenomena, which are unusual lights or observations on the moon by Earth-based telescopes. In my research, lo and behold, I discovered that J. Allen Hynek had actually directed an observatory in the United States specifically about the search for transient lunar phenomena. So I actually referenced Hynek in my astronomy papers, not only in the astronomy papers, but later on in the UFO papers. So it is interesting how our careers and paths seem to parallel to a certain extent anyways. I certainly haven't been all that involved in a lot of the other endeavors that he's been involved with. I suppose there are some similarities in that he did receive military reports of UFOs, as do I now.
You're the official recipient of UFO reports here in Canada.
Right.
Appointed by Her Majesty's government.
Absolutely. I received reports regarding some helicopter pilots who had seen something just off the coast of Halifax on November 27th, I believe, which was the last report that I had passed on to me through official channels. So the reports continue to come, and even though my focus and practical analysis of the reports is really on the Canadian aspects, I want to make it clear to people that it's not just a parochial type of phenomenon. In fact, in North America, many people may be of the opinion that it's just a North American phenomenon with Stephenville and Chicago O'Hare and Shag Harbor and Roswell and things like that. But no, there are reports from literally all around the world, and some of them are really quite fascinating.
And some of them are in your book.
Indeed.
Is there perhaps one report that you can share with us that perhaps we don't know about?
One that I found fascinating, described in the NICAP archives. But even so, it's very, very poorly known. It happened in Vietnam on June 19, 1966. So this was right in the middle of the Vietnam War. The case received very, very little attention at the time, even though there were hundreds, or more likely thousands, of military witnesses. This was in Nha Trang, which was a heavily defended coastal base in southern Vietnam. And there were about 40,000 troops stationed there. Now, Nha Trang was in a valley on a south-facing beach along the ocean. On this night in June 1966, bulldozers were clearing roads west of the base. There were some small aircraft being readied for flight on an airstrip to the east. There was even a Shell oil tanker anchored in the bay. And around 8 o'clock, many of the troops had gathered in an open area of the base to watch an outdoor movie. They had diesel generators set up to produce power for the projector. During the movie, at around 9:45, a very bright light, like a flare, suddenly appeared north of the base. And since flares were often deployed, this wasn't particularly surprising, but this light was moving in a manner that suggested it was something else. According to one witness, it dropped right towards us and stopped dead about 300 to 500 feet up. It made this little valley in the mountains around look like it was the middle of the day. As the mass of soldiers watched, the object began moving again and rose swiftly out of sight within a few seconds. One soldier reported that while the light was over the base, the generators stopped, and everything was black, and at the Air Force base a half a mile from here, all the generators stopped as well. Even the engines on the aircraft at the airfield stopped running. No cars, trucks, planes ran for about 4 minutes. Even the Shell Oil ship anchored offshore experienced the same power blackout. When everything went back on, checks of all the generators and engines, couldn't find anything wrong with them. Now, the soldier further noted that following the incident, a whole plane load of big shots from Washington arrived to investigate. And apparently, news of the event was broadcast widely on military radio stations, although nothing was ever reported stateside. And this would be a case of some concern, I suppose, since it temporarily crippled a major military base during a period of operations in an intense conflict during the war.
Yeah.
And there are hundreds, if not thousands, of witnesses. Again, a case that's remarkable, and yet we generally in ufology have no information about it.
Do you know if any researcher has tried to follow up on that case?
No, not to my knowledge. I know NICAP was given some information, and they did interview some people. But after that point, I don't know. One would think that in your listening audience on this podcast, you know, someone out there might be part of or might have been part of that military operation down in Vietnam and may have been a witness.
And if they are, please get in touch.
Absolutely. Yeah.
A fascinating story and a classic example of an unidentified affecting electrical and motors and generators.
Well, yes, on a military base.
No less. And from a tanker offshore to the base itself.
Right.
So a large area, not just flying over a car on a highway and doing
it. Again, this is the story as it exists in files and some official documents. Now, because we don't have any information on follow-up, one would assume that it was followed up to a certain degree because of where it occurred. But we don't have any information on that. Perhaps an explanation was found, perhaps not. Perhaps there is additional information that we just don't have that would allow us to understand what occurred in a completely different manner. But the point that I'm making by including this case in the book is that there are reports elsewhere in the world that really are deserving of attention and add to the fascination with this subject and really deserve more research.
Mm-hmm. But of course, I mean, that's 40 years ago now, 50 years ago.
And not only, I will point out, not only do I have cases in this book, but the publisher has set up a website off their main site, off their host, so that if people were to go to the publisher's website, which is dundurn.com/UFOs, you come up with a new blog which has been set up, which I maintain now, called the UFO Report, and which I bring to light other interesting cases. There are photographs, some of which are not in the book. There are some video clips. There are links to other places. There are ways for individuals to report their own experiences. A whole plethora of other things connected with social networking sites. We're even Twittering and Flickr. We're everywhere.
You're on Facebook.
We're on Facebook. So it's a great way to get in more information and get in contact with other individuals with an interest in the subject. And it's an added bonus, I suppose, value added to the hard copy book that you can get at fine bookstores everywhere.
Very clever of Dundurn Press to do that. D-U-N-D-U-R-N, exactly the way it sounds. Dundurn.
Right.
Yes. And speaking of Facebook, you had a book launch last week.
Yes, just last Tuesday we had a book launch to McNally Robinson, which is a very large independent chain of stores based here in Winnipeg. Good crowd. I spoke and read for about a half an hour or so. And
some good photographs taken.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I've posted some photographs from the event. In fact, my wife had bought me a life-size Marvin the Martian.
Yeah, I drooled when I saw that.
And Marvin himself attended the book launch, so it was quite an honor to have such prestigious dignitaries attend the launch of this particular book.
And the pictures that I've seen are at Facebook.
At Facebook, and They're just a sample of what's happening in the wonderful world of ufology these days.
Just in case the listener hasn't gathered by now, Rutkowski is a collector of Marvin the Martian stuff.
Marvin the Martian and almost anything UFO, although you have to be specific these days. There's just too much of it.
There is. Plastic boxes full of it here, which one day, I trust, long after I'm gone, will be worth a buck or two. And that's about it, a buck or two.
A buck or two, probably.
Antiques Roadshow in 40 years' time.
Yeah. A Marvin the Martian tie clip. You never know what that would be worth.
I'm looking forward to seeing your book. My only difficulty is I never seem to have time to read hard copy anymore.
Yeah,
you know, 7 days a week doing what I do. Out of the blue at you, how are the numbers of Canadian UFO reports for 2008?
Well, as a matter of fact, I've just started entering the 2008 reports. I've been gathering the reports all year, and it seems that this year there are even more locations where people can report their sightings. So it's actually getting harder and harder every year to gather all the cases. Not only are they reporting them to Peter Davenport and Brian Veich and people like that, they're reporting them to obscure UFO websites that I've never heard of before. So it's getting trickier and trickier. But I get the cases from Transport Canada and National Defense, plus from individuals who find links to me and to my email addresses from cruising the net and so forth. I just received an email from somebody who had seen the grand meteor from the end of October, from somebody in Alberta who simply Googled and found a link to me and wanted to report it that way. So I'm continually getting more and more reports in a variety of ways. So just in the process of entering the 2008 reports, because I had actually taken a detour, Jeff Dittman and I are, of course, approaching our 20th year of looking at Canadian UFO reports. So 2008 will be a 20-year longitudinal review of what people are seeing in Canada. And we realized that some of the earlier years, early 1990s, are incomplete online. So I went back and dug out the original reports from those years and entered them into a computer file that was compatible with the rest of them, because back then, while we were looking at DBase and Lotus and Fortran and all sorts of very unfriendly database programs that were not easily importable into our Excel file, it took quite a lot, but I actually sat down and entered each one painstakingly, one at a time, also adding in cases that we've found since then. So the numbers will be changing slightly for some of the earlier analysis. I've probably added 50 to 60 reports over the few years that we examined. So we're finding more and more cases, but I'm looking forward to seeing what 2008 has to offer. I have a feeling that we're going to be up again, probably in the 700 to 800 range, but I won't know until we've actually entered everything again. And that'll be, hopefully around Valentine's Day. And what a sweet Valentine that would be.
Wouldn't it, though?
Get your heart aflutter.
Yeah. I found that Microsoft Access is really good for dumping in additional files and attaching them to entries.
Yes.
Audio and video and photographs. And, yeah, it works really well. And a lot of people have the suite but don't know what Access does.
Yeah. Access is really good for also producing reports.
Yeah. I mean, not to plug a Microsoft product. I'm sure there are people out there who have better systems.
Or better
Possibly. Software. Yeah. The book is A World of UFOs. It's published by Dundurn Press. And if you go to dundurn.com/UFOs, you will find a blog that Chris Rutkowski is. Are you looking after that?
I'm currently the main contributor, and Dundurn is maintaining the website right now.
Good for them.
Yeah.
Shrewd businessmen.
What would we do without Web 2.0 anyway?
272 pages. It's a paperback. It came out in September. It has a bunch of photographs, maps, and diagrams, and is available online from Amazon.com, Amazon.ca, all over the place as far as I know.
Yes, in fine bookstores everywhere, we hope. And perfect for a Christmas present for that special person on your list.
that special person who's really interested in UFOs.
Yeah.
Yes. Chris Rutkowski, good luck with the book, and may you have lots of energy to complete the survey by Valentine's Day, and look forward to talking to you again.
Indeed. Thanks a lot, Errol.
Thank you, Chris. Au revoir.
I was laying in my bed, it was the middle of the night. I heard a strange noise, and it gave me a fright. I jumped out of my bed, and to my surprise, there was a spaceship sitting in my yard outside. They were rocking and rolling.
Glad to have been in your ears and appreciate your interest and your subscriptions. Until next time.
That's this edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli. Send any questions or comments to sdi@virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the copyright of Random Fit Productions. Join us again for more Strange Days Indeed from the Virtually Strange Network.